Mr. Schulman here?
Sorry, I thought we were third on the list.
No. Good morning.
May it please the court. This court should reverse each of the reverse the PTAB in each of the five reexaminations on appeal for two reasons. First, and the threshold issue in this case, is that the examiner overstepped her statutory bounds when she rejected all of the claims on appeal over art or combinations of art that exceeded the substantial new question of patentability, in contradiction of this court's holding in Belkin. Namely, we hold that under the statute, available prior art may only be considered to answer the specific question of patentability found by the director.
Isn't Belkin clearly distinguishable from your case? Because there, it was an instance where the director had specifically found the contested prior art did not raise a substantial question. So that's all Belkin was dealing with, that particular scenario. And that's clearly not what happened here. The director did not make a finding that there was not a substantial question, right?
I don't believe factually that that's true. And the reason is, the director affirmatively found that there was no SNQ.
In Belkin,
it's not clear whether the director affirmatively found that there was no SNQ, because the procedure is the art was presented in Belkin. So in Belkin, four pieces of prior art were presented to the office. The office found an SNQ based on one piece of art. It's not clear whether there was ever an order in Belkin that said, and we also don't find an SNQ as to these. The office typically doesn't do that. The office will issue an order identifying the SNQ, and then implicitly, it must have rejected all of the other requests.
Well, I'm reading from Belkin. It says, we agree with the director that the board did not err in not considering issues that the director had found not to raise a substantial new question of patentability.
And that's absolutely true. And in this case, so the procedural posture in Belkin really didn't matter. And the reason was, the only reason it mattered in Belkin whether or not either the PTAB or this court could address the art that did not raise the SNQ is because the statute prohibits it. If the statute allowed either the office or the PTAB to consider art that did not raise the SNQ, then Belkin's failure to petition to include that as an SNQ wouldn't have mattered. The only reason that failure to petition to include that as an SNQ mattered is because at that point you are limited to what is in the SNQ. And when this court reviewed Belkin, Belkin had asked this court to look at that other prior art. And interestingly, in this case, all of the art that formed the basis for the two grounds of rejection, so Wanky, Sakai, and then either GB853 or Heyman, were before the examiner, at least in four of the cases, prior to determining that there was an SNQ. And so we could make the same argument that implicitly the office declined to find an SNQ based on that art. And again, when the director issues an order identifying the art for the resolution of the question, it never, at least in my experience, goes on and says, and we declined to find an SNQ as to everything else that's out there. It doesn't do that. It identifies the SNQ. And so implicitly the fact is, the office must have declined to find an SNQ based on Sakai, Wanky, GB853, and Heyman because it was available art prior to finding the SNQ, at least on every reexamination except the 250, which was the first one that was filed. How does that
help you? I'm just looking back over the history of trying to keep some kind of control on the reexamination process. Aren't you better off having as full a reexamination as is conceivably available, or else you'll just go through it again at trial?
Frankly, Your Honor, no, I don't think so. In this case, there are two specific reasons. There's a procedural reason and a substantive reason. The substantive reason is that if we get to the point of resolving the SNQ and a reexamination certificate issues, as I believe the statute requires, at that point, we go back to the district court and lift the stay. And in this case, all these patents have been stayed for over 4 years in the district court, in some cases with only 2 years left on the patent. In the meantime, if Belkin applies here, and as on page 51 of our opening brief, we identify those claims affected by Belkin and the form in which they should have been allowed because they had overcome the SNQ. And we have we have three patents that have claims that should have been allowed in their original form without amendment. And that fact brings us back to the district court without implicating intervening rights, which in this case is probably worth tens of millions of dollars in damages. I would welcome the opportunity to go back to the district court, even if a subsequent reexamination were filed, because it's the district court's discretion, and said, you know what, we've waited long enough. We've been stayed for 4 years. We've only got 2 years left. The third-party requester, when the Belkin issue was raised 2 years ago, could have filed another petition for reexamination. The director, sua sponte, could have and should have followed the statute and issued a new order for reexamination, but that's not where we are. And so that's the substantive issue. We would be back in the district court addressing tens of millions of dollars of intervening rights because we shouldn't have had to amend the claims. The procedural issue is also what happened here, which is if an SMQ is properly found under Section 303 and 304, what happens next is there is an opportunity for the patent owner to file a patent owner's statement. So there's at least one opportunity to address the SMQ. Then if that prior art merits a rejection, because that's a higher standard than the SMQ, you get another opportunity to respond to the first office action. So that's a second opportunity, as of right, to address that prior art. What happened here is the rejections were made in a final rejection, which is now characterized by the office as basically like a post hoc, well, that was really an SMQ, but it was a final office action. And under the rules, the rights of a patent holder or an applicant to address new arguments, make new amendments, introduce new evidence, either by way of declaration or otherwise, are severely limited after final office action. It's at the discretion of the examiner whether to enter that.
Do you not have an opportunity to respond to those references? I mean, I think you actually were the person that brought forward some of those references, right?
There were IDSs filed earlier in the case, but the rejections didn't happen until they became final. And so at that point...
But wait a minute, on the IDSs, you cited the prior art that's in question now, right?
Not all of it. GB853 and the Heyman reference were of record already in two of the patents. They were in the original prosecution history of two of the patents on appeal. That was the 790 and 905. They were in the original prosecution history. So they were already of record. Sakai was submitted prior to an SNQ by the third-party requester, prior to an SNQ being found in four of the cases, all four except for the 250. The IDSs were for two reasons. One, all five cases were, well, they originally before two examiners, and one examiner had three, one examiner had two, and then they were combined to be all before the same examiner. We filed an IDS to make the record complete, again, because the case was in litigation, so lest we come back to the district court and somebody say, well, you hit the ball, you didn't file an IDS, get rid of that issue, it's purely litigation
profile. Okay, so you refer to some of these references in your IDS, right? Is it your view that the patent office, therefore, doesn't look at that? I mean, you were the ones that brought this prior art forward as having some relevance here, right?
Whether the IDS requires it, whether the patent office rules, because there's nothing in the statute that requires an IDS to be brought. So these are the patent office rules that say you submit an IDS.
Okay.
That doesn't trump the statute, which says available prior art is only that which forms the basis of the SNQ. That was the holding of Belkin. And in fact, this court in Belkin, when it addressed the idea that the patent office should search all available prior art, because that's what the 37 CFR says, this court said no, that the statute trumps the regulations, which trumps the MPEP. And in fact, what they said was, they said, thus the fact that section, this is on page 1384 of Belkin, the second to last paragraph of that page, because this was Belkin's argument that you do a search of all available prior art. This court said, the fact that section 1.104 states the examiner shall make a thorough investigation of available prior art does not affect the analysis. In any event, in order to reconcile what may otherwise appear to be conflicting provisions, this is the holding that I cited, we hold that under the statute, available prior art may only be considered to answer the specific questions of patentability found by the director. The fact of the matter is that this court, we have a limited statutory scheme here where there is a limited new question of patentability to an issued patent, and a limited review is initiated solely to resolve that question.
Now, the directors, one of their arguments and the board's argument was that Belkin was inter pares and that therefore there's a distinction to be drawn between the ex parte here and that case. What is your response to that?
The statute that this court construed, the inter pares statute, is identical to the ex parte statute. If you look on page 39 and 40 of our opening brief, we lay the statutes side by side. And the language that this court interpreted was sections 312 and 313 of the Interparty Statute, which lines up virtually identically to section 303 and 304 of the Ex-Party Statute. Furthermore, the fact that Belkin was interparties, while they referenced repeatedly that it was interparties, the fact that it was interparties really had nothing to do with that statutory construction argument. There's no reason why the fact that there might be a third-party requester as opposed to a completely ex-parte proceeding, that didn't affect the analysis at all.
What about Belkin, where it says it's 1383? It's funny because it's talking about interparties, but it cites the ex-parte statute. But
correct.
It cites the parenthetical quote that on his own initiative, at any time, the director may determine whether substantial new question of patentability is raised by patents and publications discovered by him. Doesn't that give the director enormous leeway in the conduct of these proceedings?
Well, absolutely. And we wouldn't contest that the director can't initiate a new SNQ by finding a substantial new question of patentability. At any time means at any time, which means, but the director has to restart that process. You can't read 303 as binding and then ignore section 304 and 305, which says you get the patent owner statement, then the office has to issue a rejection. We're not contesting that the director could not, sua sponte, have used this art to find an SNQ. But what should have happened is once the claims were found to overcome the SNQ, either because in original form the first rejection went beyond, was used for different art, so the SNQ was overcome, or the SNQ was not an issue, or because the claims were amended to then overcome the SNQ. At that point, and Belkin says if there is no substantial new question of patentability, there is no reexamination. The reexamination should have ended, and a certificate should have issued. At that point, the director could, as could the third-party requester, have requested an additional reexamination. And the fact that the statute permits that is fine. We're not contesting that. It can't do it in the middle of, and during, and within an existing reexamination proceeding. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'd like to begin by addressing Belkin. You are exactly correct, Judge Prost, that Belkin concerned a very different issue. What was at stake in Belkin was there was an inter-parties reexamination where the third-party requester, the issue before the board was whether or not they had jurisdiction to consider a challenge by the third-party requester in the inter-parties reexamination to the initial SNQ determination. And the court, the board and the court quite properly concluded based on 312C, which expressly provides that in an inter-parties reexamination, neither party has a right to appeal the initial SNQ determination. So that was really what was at issue. As a corollary holding, what the court held was that when there has been an affirmative determination of that there is a certain reference or prior art does not raise an SNQ, that the court cannot then, that the examiner cannot then write a rejection based on that prior art. And that is, neither of those issues are present here. What's present here is an ex parte reexamination. 303 is actually different from 312. 303C actually provides an opportunity for the patent owner to actually challenge the SNQ determination. Here, Pactiv declined to do that, it didn't preserve its rights. But there was no question here about jurisdiction. The board would have had jurisdiction to consider any challenge to the SNQ determination, but what Pactiv failed to do was to preserve its rights. Now, with respect to...
You're not drawing a distinction between ex parte and who initiates the examination, is that right?
Ex parte and inter parties,
yeah.
Is there a distinction in who can initiate? Yes,
yep.
There is, because in 303, in the ex parte context, actually the director can initiate as well as on his own, sua sponte, as well as...
A distinction with respect to the substantial new question.
A distinction...
There still has to be a substantial new question, isn't that right?
There has to be a substantial new question.
I thought you were, but like Judge Newman, I thought one of the arguments you were making in your brief is that even if Belkin is read more broadly, it doesn't matter because there is a distinction to be made between the inter partes and the ex parte procedures. Am I wrong about that?
The difference in the procedures, well, there are a couple differences in the procedures. One is 303 gives even additional latitude in the 303 for the director to actually initiate the reexamination. And also in the 303 versus 312, so there's differences in the right of appeal to the board on the S&Q determination. But really what's relevant here is that in Belkin, what was the art that the court said could not be utilized in a rejection was art that had been determined to not raise an S&Q. Here, all of the prior art that's being used in the rejections did raise an S&Q, and there's no question about that. So that's the primary distinction here. Belkin really doesn't have...
Well, you're right about that it did raise an S&Q, but it was not the original S&Q that was presented, right?
It was, well, some of them actually was the original S&Q. Some of the rejections were founded on the actual S&Qs that were proposed by the requester.
But this is all about, I mean, your friend's argument here is about the fact that there was additional prior art brought in that wasn't included in the original S&Q, right?
No. There are two things that happened during prosecution, and I will take you also to the statute and to your own case law to say why I think that it's completely appropriate what the examiner did here. But two things that happened during prosecution. One is that they amended their claims multiple times after the first office action, and secondly, they did bring in prior art in the IDS. Now, they contest this, but the 853 patent, the British patent, and Hammond were first presented in this reexaminations in an IDS presented by them. And you see that at A1051, A2723, and A1846. Now, the Sakai reference, in the first two reexaminations, which were the 250 and the 790, that reference was presented by them after the first office action, and that's in A1051 and A3397. In the others, Sakai, which came on a little bit later, the third-party requester raised Sakai, and they were actually Sakai was used in the first office actions.
Is there a due process problem or some sort of response problem that you called the exchange with your friend in terms of that if it had come up originally, they would have had more, as I understood it, they would have had more or a different opportunity to respond, and that an opportunity was limited in the context in which it arose here? Is that fair?
There was no due process issue here. They had no lost opportunities. First of all, with respect to the S&Q determinations, they had the opportunity to challenge the S&Q determination at every step along the way, and they chose not to. In fact, after the order, they chose not to. In two of them, they waived that right at A2695 and A3241. In the others, they didn't file a statement at A426, A1007, and A1832. After the first office action, they could have again challenged the implicit S&Q determinations in the rejections there. They did not challenge the S&Q. They did not after the final rejection or even in their appeal brief before the board. Now, with respect to the rejections, they could have presented, they were given opportunities to present evidence all the way along the way. After the first office action, they presented two declarations by Mr. Del Duca at A1026 and A1097. After the final rejection, they came in and they explained that, and they brought in the third Del Duca declaration, and they explained that this was necessary because of the final rejection with new art. And that's at A1179 that they brought in the third. This is just an example on the 250 patent. And finally, even in the reply brief to the board, they brought in another declaration, the Hunt Declaration, which was even that was considered by the board. So there was no, really, they amended their claims multiple times throughout prosecution. In the case of the 250, they amended at A1074, again at A1091, and at A1173. There was no lack of due process in this reexamination.
You mentioned the distinction between the inter parties and the ex parties reviews. As a matter of policy, why and how should we treat them differently or recognize a distinction?
I mean, the primary distinctions, again, are that the director, for obvious reason, ex parte, the director can initiate an ex parte reexamination on his own initiative. The other difference is in the appeal rights in 312. Neither party can challenge an S&Q determination before the board. That's a petitionable matter only. In the ex parte context, the patent owner can challenge an S&Q determination. The third party requester cannot. There are differences when the order issues. There's an opportunity for a statement in an ex parte, but not an inter parties, and the third party requester can reply in the ex parte. Third party requester can participate more actively in the inter parties, obviously. Those are the primary differences between the two. But what's really at issue here is whether or not, and what was decided in Belkin was very limited, was simply that prior art that has been affirmatively determined to not raise an S&Q cannot be used in a rejection, and that's not what was going on here. Now, the statute, 303, obviously, as Judge Prost alluded to, gives broad discretion to the director to use to combine art that's been submitted by the third-party requester with other prior art to discover their own prior art. 305...
But your friend construes that as not being as broad as I was suggesting, because he says that only means that the director can come in and file something new. That doesn't mean that they can keep on adding stuff to the case, to the proceeding that's pending, right? That was what I understood his response.
That was what his response is, but I think it's a fair indication that the director is given broad latitude in combining prior art. And moreover, when you go to 305, 305 directs that reexamination is to be conducted according to the provisions established for initial examination under sections 132 and 133. So it, 305 is just a signal that once you get past, and at the whole point of the S&Q process is to weed out those requests so that the patent owner is not burdened with frivolous requests for reexamination, so the office isn't burdened. So the whole process of 303 and 304 is to sort of weed out those bad requests for reexamination. But once it's determined that there is prior art that raises a substantial new question, then you go to 305, then you move into the reexamination process.
There's a one additional safeguard which has been at issue throughout, which is when if there is new art, but let's say in all fairness, this is information that ought to be of record, ought to be of cited in the give and take on reexamination, whether it's ex parte or inter parties. How does one get that into the loop? And the objection that we hear is that it has to be brought up early enough in the cycle so they have an opportunity to go through the system of responding and amending. And so it does, in a sense, take us back to a due process question. Does it not? That there are additional procedures rather than fewer if, in all fairness and objectivity, there is new art to be cited. So aren't they right in that case? Not that there's an automatic allowance or anything else, but they have to have an adequate opportunity to respond, and the way it was done, they didn't have that opportunity.
And they didn't have that opportunity. Well, they did have that opportunity. They had the opportunity to present all of this evidence. They brought in declarations after the final rejection. They brought in declarations even during the appeal
process. Final rejection?
Yes.
Well, I think unless the practice has changed dramatically, that's not so easy.
And the reason it was permitted here was because they came in and they said, well, we have not seen this particular combination of prior art before, and I point you to A1179 with respect to the 250 patent, and this happened in each of them. The PACTIF came in and explained that this rejection was new, this prior art they hadn't seen before, and they were permitted to bring in their declaration, and it was fully considered. That's the third Del Duca declaration. But moreover, I think what's important here is this practice that they're suggesting would be extremely inefficient. Every single time that the examiner was to stumble upon another reference, or there could be even a simple limitation where they needed to apply a different reference, we'd have to go back and go through this 2-month waiting period before and go through this whole process. And that's simply contrary to what 305's mandate, that reexaminations are to be conducted with special dispatch.
But the pressure of inefficiency, this is exactly it. And I would think especially in inter-parties re-examination, where it isn't a question of what the examiner stumbles upon, but what the adverse party thinks to bring forward when requesting the inter-parties re-exam.
Well, this is the ex-party re-examination here, but in this case, the examiner applied those very references that were brought forward by the patent owner.
Okay, ex-party, but not initiated by the patent owner.
Not initiated by the patent owner, no.
Okay.
But the references that were utilized in the final rejections were references that had what were brought to the attention of the examiner by the patent owner. And they never alleged that they were not aware of these references and could have provided them earlier.
Indeed, why shouldn't the examiner have an obligation to cite all of those first time around if they're to be relied upon? They're in the record. They're in the history.
These references, the 853, I respectfully disagree, Judge Newman, the 853 and the Hammond references were not part of the record, the re-examination record, until they were brought into the record by the patent owner.
But isn't there a search obligation on the examiner?
Certainly it's a search obligation, and the examiner did the best they could, but they had art that was presented to them, and they do the best they can, but they don't necessarily always find every art at the get-go. Any additional questions?
No.
Thank you.
There's a couple of points I want to make. First, directly to that conversation you were just having about the searching of the art and whether or not the office had an opportunity to make these rejections. In the 457 patent alone, which is on page 27 of our 28 of our brief, there were 33 substantial new questions of patentability. And still, they managed to find rejections that did not form the basis of any of those 33 SNQs. So it's not like they didn't have an opportunity, didn't do the search. They did all that. And they still managed to reject claims based on rejections that were not part of the SNQ. And I want to talk about first this idea of the...
Let me make sure I understand this. So you would require a separate SNQ determination for every piece of prior art that's added?
If it is a new combination or a new question, Section 304 requires the director to issue an order for resolution of that question. This whole idea, and what I heard is, well, there were SNQs. No, Section 304 says the director must issue an order identifying the SNQ. You can't read that out of the statute. Now, I want to talk about this idea that Belkin had some sort of a different scope. The PTO makes a remarkable admission on page 50 of its brief, and there it's trying to address its prior position in Belkin, where it took the position the PACTIV advocated here, namely, 2 years ago, and trying to distinguish that position. It says, quote, and the director acknowledged, talking about its Belkin brief, and the director acknowledged that there is no distinction between Section 303 ex parte and Section 312 inter partes only, and they emphasize only, with respect to the scope of available prior art. Well, if the scope of available prior art is the same as inter partes, and they briefed in Belkin that inter partes is limited to that question, period, end of discussion, and now they're saying it's the same as ex partes, well, that disposes of really what the central issue is in the case. Everything having to do with 312C...
I'm confused here, because I don't think that's what they're saying. I think they're saying that in Belkin, there was an explicit rejection of the SNQ, and that was what Belkin was about. So their comments with respect to what they were arguing in Belkin don't really have a bearing. I mean, in this circumstance, at least there's a distinction to be drawn because there was no explicit rejection, right?
I don't know whether there was an explicit rejection or not. If you look on pages of the appendix 3953 and 3954, and this is reprinted in large part on page 18 of our reply brief, this is the PTO's brief in Belkin, and this is important because it addresses that question specifically. They say Belkin next argues that 312 does not restrict the universe of prior art that may be considered during a reexamination. This court expressly rejected this argument. They cite In Re Recreative. And at that point, there's a footnote that says Recreative interpreted 303, which is the ex parte, but we're talking about 312. Belkin argues the distinction is not relevant in determining the scope of the available prior art. The director agrees. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Court is now adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.
Thank you.